Don't fear the methane, baby. Don't fear the methane. Just take my hand and remember, God wouldn't let that happen. Dr. Michio Kaku is my guest, and believe it or not, he was actually advertised to be on here tonight, and coming up shortly will, in fact, be talking about SETI. Now, that's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and, well, I always thought people like Dr. Kaku kind of winked and said, I don't know, if we got some extra money, that might be all right, but kind of a wink and a nod, and maybe it's wasting money, and they're not out there, and that kind of stuff. But he wants to talk about it, so we will in a moment. Professor Kaku, just before we move towards SETI, Jerry in San Diego says, well, then, Art, why can't we use methane gas as fuel? It burns.
We can, but it also creates carbon dioxide when it burns. And so, in fact, you know, anything that undergoes combustion will release carbon dioxide. So that's the basic problem. We have to get away from burning.
All right.
If you think about it, you know, burning is the central core of modern civilization, right? That's why we have to get away from thinking about things that produce large quantities of carbon dioxide. And remember, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere a lot longer than methane. Methane is more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, but methane doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long. So anyway, for doomsday scenarios where you could literally collapse the atmosphere in a relatively short period of time, methane is one. Methane from Siberia, when Siberia thaws out from the bottom of the oceans. And the third doomsday scenario is actually mentioned in your movie, Day After Tomorrow, where Greenland melts and fresh water is injected into the Atlantic, which destabilizes the Gulf Stream. And that could cause Europe to freeze over. It was Benjamin Franklin who first figured out 200 years ago the role of the Gulf Stream when he was crossing the Atlantic centuries ago. And anything that disrupts that Gulf Stream could have serious repercussions on the weather and could have a catastrophic implication for especially Northern Europe. England, as you know, if you take a globe, England has the same latitude as parts of Canada. So England, by rights, should be frozen over. England has no right to be as warm as it is.
Except for the ocean currents.
Except for the ocean currents, which could be disrupted by fresh water. And this has happened in the past, by the way. It's not science fiction. It's already happened in the past. And we don't know how fast it took place, but we think that in just a few years, the Gulf Stream was disrupted in the past, which caused many ice ages.
Interestingly, Professor, even recently they've noticed a slowing of the Gulf Stream. They've noticed a splintering of the Gulf Stream. Worrisome, not yet catastrophic, but worrisome.
Worrisome because if you take a look at the salinity content, that is the salt content of the North Atlantic, it's thinning out. Because of the influx of large amounts of fresh water from Greenland coming down. And that could disrupt the thermohaline cycle, of which the Gulf Stream is part. And that's happened in the past. In the past, the thermohaline cycles have been disrupted, causing catastrophic changes of the weather in a very short period of time, just a few years, we think. And so then we're no longer talking about decades and decades. We're talking about tipping points. And once the tipping point is reached, we're talking about catastrophic collapse of the weather in a very short period of time.
So we should watch, and if you begin setting up shop somewhere in the Rockies, it's time to worry.
It's time to worry in the sense that there could be extremes of weather. You know, farmers, for example, who snicker at all of this, they have to confront droughts. The Midwest could become a dust bowl in the future. We already are being beset with droughts near Georgia and places
yes.
like that. We could have even more massive droughts. So in some areas we could have flooding. In the other areas we could have droughts because global warming predicts swings in the climate, not simply a uniform heating of the earth, but we're talking about larger and larger violent swings of the atmosphere and the climate of the earth as the temperature begins to rise. It's not going to be uniform at all. Okay.
So swings and radical weather, and we're certainly getting a lot of that. All right, Professor, when I saw that you actually wanted to come on the air tonight and talk about SETI, I went, wow, really? Because I had always thought that your attitude about SETI was kind of, okay, if we have extra money, maybe, but it might be a waste, and kind of like that.
Well, I like to look at the big picture, and there's no point piddling with equipment that is too primitive and too cheap not to pick up anything. And
you mean like Arecibo?
The equipment that we have today is old, it's out of date, and we only use it part-time. Now, last month, and this hit the newspapers, last month the Allen Telescope Array went online. Paul Allen is the co-founder of Microsoft. He's a billionaire, and he has funded to the tune of $25 million the Allen Telescope Array to jumpstart the SETI project to create the Manhattan Project of SETI. We're talking about up to 350, count them, 350 radio telescope dishes exclusively designed to look for extraterrestrial intelligence in outer space. 42 went online just last month, and eventually 350 will go online. And that should increase the sensitivity and search scans by about a factor of 1,000. So we're talking about 1,000 times more than all the accumulated SETI searches of the past.
So that's enough to get you excited.
Well, I'm not sure they're going to find anything. However, this is the best bet in a generation. In a generation. You know, once in a generation we get an opportunity like this, right, where when a billionaire decides to, you know, throw $25 million your way to create 350 gigantic radio telescopes, this could set the gold standard for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
What do you think talked him into that kind of donation?
Well, I think, you know, he's interested in science. You know, being a co-founder of Microsoft, he's interested in computers and rockets and stuff like that. He helped to back the X Prize, the Spaceship One, which won the X Prize for blasting off into outer space on a commercial flight.
Right,
and he wants to jumpstart commercial exploration of space, and he wants to jumpstart SETI, where his billions will make a difference. Okay.
Well, if you had been the one trying to get the money, and you had been in front of Paul Allen trying to make the case for however many million to look for intelligent life out there, how would you have made the case?
I would have said that the scientific community snickers and laughs at SETI because everybody knows that the equipment is out of date. We only can use it part-time. Most of it is used for pure science. And, of course, we can't find aliens because we're not looking hard enough. Mm-hmm. And it would take a massive influx of funds. The government ain't doing it. And you could do it. You could be part of world history if we make contact with alien life in outer space. That would be the biggest event in the history of Homo sapiens since we left the trees.
Well, if I were Paul Allen, I would say, okay, that's fine and well, but make the case that you think they're there.
Well, first, his name would be on it. His name would be on every single newspaper in the world because it was his telescope, that found it.
Sure.
And second of all, most scientists, when they look at the numbers, believe they're out there. There are over 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and we've only scanned about 1,000 of them. Get this. We've only scanned in detail about 1,000 stars in 100 billion stars in our own backyard, and there are 100 billion galaxies within the range of our telescopes. So altogether, we even know how many stars there are in the visible universe, 100 billion times 100 billion. That's how many stars there are total in the visible universe. And we've only scanned 1,000 of them. And, of course, we're going to snicker at SETI. Of course we're going to say this is kind of like a useless project because, you know, there's so many stars to scan, and we've only scanned 1,000 of them. And we might even be scanning in the wrong frequency using wrong methods.
We might.
So my attitude is think big. Look at the big picture. You have to jumpstart this. And this is precisely where a billionaire can make a difference. Mm-hmm. He made a difference with the X Prize. Now the commercialization of outer space is not out of the question. And he could make a difference with regards to making contact or eavesdropping on conversations of ET in outer space. It's not out of the question anymore.
What are the odds that a transmission, an incidental transmission, or many incidental transmissions, I mean, let's take Earth as a case, the electromagnetic radiation that we emit right now at all kinds of frequencies, microwave and otherwise, what are the odds that would make it out 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000 light years? In other words, well, actually, it couldn't be that many light years. It could only be, I guess, back to, as in contact, the first German transmission, perhaps.
Yeah, well, assuming that these civilizations are old, and assuming that they've been, you know, broadcasting at the electromagnetic spectrum for a while.
Good point.
We would expect to have made contact with some of them that are, you know, a few thousand light years from Earth. But like I said, we've only scanned 1,000 nearby stars. And even then, we've only looked at one frequency, which is the hydrogen frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're like ants in an anthill trying to scan for intelligent life in outer space when there are, you know, huge construction crews working around you, and you are totally oblivious to the existence of humans because you're looking for other ants.
Okay, you said there are many scientists who believe that there is life out there, that it's abundant life. Are you one of them?
Yeah, I think so. I think a minority says that the Earth is quite rare and that life is so precious that it probably has only sprung up a few times in the history of the galaxy. First of all, there are 100 billion galaxies, and our own galaxy has 100 billion stars. So I think the probability of intelligent life being in outer space is almost 100%. I think it's a no-brainer. Okay. The question, of course, is the distance. The distance between these stars is vast. Our own galaxy is 100,000 light years across. It takes 100,000 years for a telegram going at the speed of light from one end of the galaxy to the other end of the galaxy. And but again, the universe is quite old. The universe is 13.7 billion years. We know that number now to within 1% accuracy. Let me say that again. The universe is 13.7 billion years old. And for us, it only took us 100,000 years since modern humans walked the surface of the Earth to create all this technology that we have today. Most of it created just within the last 100 years.
Okay, let me ask this again. What are the chances that incidental transmissions of the kind that we're making, perhaps the one transmission from Arecibo aside, it was very short, what are the chances of those incidental transmissions being detected out many, 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 many light years? I'm only asking this so that I can imagine the reverse.
Okay, it depends on which estimate you choose, okay? Frank Drake, the astronomer who created this whole scenario, estimated that there are 10,000 planets in our galaxy harboring intelligent life forms.
Okay.
Carl Sagan was even more optimistic and said maybe a million, okay? Since then, astronomers have scaled down these numbers a bit. Because we do realize that the Earth is quite different from the 250 planets that we discovered orbiting other stars. So far, we've only found Jupiter-sized stars, Jupiter-sized planets orbiting other stars, and they have quite eccentric orbits, highly elliptical or very, very close to the mother sun, in which case there's no Goldilocks zone where you are not too far, not too close to the sun, and you're just in the right zone to have liquid water, which is the universal solvent, which is the amniotic fluid of life, liquid water, which is quite rare in the universe.
Okay.
So given these numbers, and now given the fact that our ability to scan the stars will be increased by a factor of 1,000, okay, we're now in the ballpark, okay? It's no longer 0.0001% probability of finding something. Now I think we have a few percent probability. We're you know, we're on the radar screen now. Before, we were not even on the radar screen. Now,
so,
I think we have enough, quote, radar ability to scan 1,000 times more efficiently.
Let's just take the numbers and the numbers of Earth-like planets that now are considered possible with what we know versus 1,000 times better listening capacity.
Right.
What do you suppose that makes it percentage-wise.
Right. The odds are going to be even better next year when Kepler goes up in orbit. Kepler is the first American satellite to be able to detect Earth-like planets orbiting other star systems, up mm-hmm. to 600. And that's next year now. We're not talking 20 years in the future. We're talking next year. The Kepler satellite will be launched by NASA. It will detect perhaps up to 600 Earth-like planets in outer space. And we will have an existential shock looking at the night sky, realizing that many of the familiar constellations have twins of the Earth on them. That will direct the SETI project. Once we identify hundreds of Earth-like twins in outer space, we will then focus all these radio telescopes on these planets, searching for liquid water, searching for evidence of oxygen, searching for evidence of amino acids. That will focus the search rather than looking for a needle in the haystack.
And searching
exactly
for signals, right?
Right. So in other words, we're entering the golden age of SETI. Before, it was a bunch of amateurs puttering around in their basement. We're entering the golden age where, A, we have the Allen telescope array going online. B, Kepler goes up in orbit. We'll know precisely where these Earth-like planets are. We'll look for evidence of liquid water on these planets and amino acids and oxygen. We'll focus the SETI project on precisely these Earth-like twins in outer space. And we could very well hit the jackpot.
Well, again, I'm going to come right back to this question. What are the odds of detecting relatively incidental transmissions?
I would give it a few percent. Okay? Given the fact that there are a lot of stars to look for, I would say that for the first time, we have a shot now. The probability is no longer 0.0001 of finding evidence of intelligent life. I think it's a few percent. That doesn't mean we're going to find it.
Right. Even looking at our own incidental transmissions, mm-hmm. how far out do you suppose it's realistic to imagine somebody could be receiving signals from Earth?
Well, our transmissions are only 50 light years away from us. There's a sphere 50 light years
right.
in radius expanding at the speed of light.
Theoretically, they could be out that far, right?
Right. However, these intelligent life forms may be centuries, millennia, millions of years old. They could be quite ancient, and they could be much wiser than us. They maybe have access to tremendous amounts of energy that can be detected over thousands of light years. Or even if they disintegrated and killed themselves, their radiation would live on even after their death, and that would be picked up by our radio telescopes. So my only point is not that we're going to find evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, but we have the best shot in a generation. The best, the convergence of two technologies, Kepler going up next year in orbit. The French already have a satellite in orbit, by the way, the Corot satellite. It's smaller. And the Corot satellite is already looking for Earth-like twins in outer space. And also this massive influx of energy, massive influx of money from Paul Allen. These two factors are beginning to mean that we're entering the golden age of possibly making contact with intelligent life.
You remember the beginning of contact when the signal got weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker the further out you got?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess that's what I'm asking in a way. In other words, once out of the atmosphere, would the signal go on indefinitely without becoming weaker, or would there be forces that would slowly make it weaker and harder and harder to detect until finally, however many light years out, it would be essentially gone?
Well, there's no friction in outer space. There's gas in outer space to absorb electromagnetic radiation. But the radiation would damp roughly as the inverse square law, similar to a light bulb. If you go away from the light bulb, the energy from the light bulb drops as the inverse square.
Right.
So if you double your distance, the amount of light hitting you went down by a factor of four. Okay. So it does damp. However, these radio telescopes are extremely sensitive. In principle, you could pick up an emission from a transistor radio, billions of miles from the Earth. That's how sensitive these things are. And we're going to have 350 of them. That's an enormous amount of firepower. And we're not going to have to share the time with pure scientists. This is a dedicated system of 350 radio telescopes exclusively for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Well, that certainly is encouraging.
Very encouraging. This is the best shot we've had in a generation. And again, I'm not saying that we're going to make contact, but I'm saying that this is the best shot we've ever had. The convergence of these two technologies, looking for extrasolar planets, and
Professor, hold it right there. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm just a questioning son of a gun. But if Professor Kaku is getting excited about SETI, then I'm going to get excited about SETI. If we have 350 dishes pointed in directions looking with 1,000 times the look or listening power that we previously had, and there's really a significant chance, as compared to what we had, of detecting life elsewhere, there could not be anybody more for it than myself, and I'm sure many of you will be right back. Dr. Kaku, I've had the pleasure to interview people from SETI previously, and I've always asked, you know, if we got a signal, if we actually received something that was unambiguously alien, would we, honestly, I would ask, would we hear about it right away, or would it be some sort of national security issue right away? And they always say, oh, no, Art, you'd hear about it right away. Oh, it'd be all over the internet, it'd be everywhere, it'd be out right away. Do you agree with that?
No. I think
I don't either.
That, well, there are protocols being drafted about what happens if, you know, the Allen Telescope Array does pick up, unmistakable signals from intelligent life in outer space. And, of course, you know, you're going to get a lot of techies saying freedom of speech, freedom of speech.
Oh, yeah.
But let's be real about this, okay? It could set off a panic. It could set off all sorts of bizarre shenanigans on the part of, you know, crazies out there, as well as, you know, well-meaning people confronted with the existence of other people that are maybe even superior to us, right?
Or even probably superior to us.
Probably they will be, because our technology is only 300 years old. You know, 300 years ago, we didn't have much technology to talk about at all. And in outer space, 300 years is nothing. Even a million years is nothing when you look at the age of the galaxy. You know, the galaxy is about 10 billion years old. So the chances are that these civilizations could be a million years ahead of us.
How much do you know about the protocols?
Well, some have been drafted, you know, but again, you know, no one takes them seriously because, you know, we used to all snicker at SETI.
I know.
We used to always say that these are just exercises in futility.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, you know, billionaires are beginning to put up money and, you know, NSF and the government is backing these billionaires with extra funds, now it's serious. Now we're in the big leagues. We're no longer in the minor leagues now. Now we're in the big leagues with big equipment, the kind of equipment that they always dreamed about is now being built. And now the protocols, I think, are going to have to be revised. And I think it would be downright stupid to simply say that if we make contact, we'll put it on the internet and leave it at that, right?
Yeah, yeah. How do you imagine, well, first of all, I guess I should ask, do you really know what the protocols are? And if you do, are you unable to discuss them?
Well, no. The several versions of protocols exist, okay? And I've seen versions of some, and they're all laughable, okay, in the sense that no one takes them seriously. And
well, for the sake of this discussion, which you seem to be taking seriously based on the advances, then they better take the protocol seriously, huh?
Yeah, I think they would have to take protocol seriously. They're going to have to get rid of this freedom of speech kind of attitude that, you know, everything's on the internet, everything should be free. Because, you know, people could be hurt. People could be hurt if they realize, you know, as Arthur C. Clarke once said, either there is intelligent life in outer space or there isn't. Either thought is frightening.
Yes, it is.
So I think that they should put a lid on it if they ever do pick up an unmistakable signal. And it should be a matter of national security. You know, all those science fiction movies that we've seen ever since we were kids,
yes.
There's some truth to that.
Well, of course there is. There would be religious disruption. There would be disruption of other establishments and infrastructure, you know, it would be disturbing. There's no question about it. So you think that, well, even in contact, you remember the military came marching in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you imagine it might not occur that way, but that it would become a national security issue. It would go to the highest levels and stay there.
Right, and given the fact that the government is, you know, putting up the other half of the bill, you know, Paul Allen is not putting up 100%.
Oh, that ensures.
$25 million.
Yes.
The government is putting up a lot, and other private donors are putting up a lot. They're going to have some say in this matter, and you know, all sorts of things could happen. Plus, you know, unscrupulous private individuals will probably want to jump in on it, and they want to make contact with Intelligent Life and for their own private gain. And, you know, the aliens are not going to know who these humans are. And they can get all sorts of signals from entrepreneurs trying to make a quick buck out of being the first to make contact, you know, make a dialogue with these aliens from outer space.
Now, a dialogue is a little difficult considering the distances probably involved.
Well, you never know. If they come, if they want to come visit us, if they know where we are. Oh, by the way, the other thing is I don't think that we should advertise our presence to them until we know their intentions.
Oh, excellent.
You know, chances are they are carnivorous. You know, predators are smarter than prey. You know, foxes are smarter than rabbits. Rabbits are not too smart. All they have to do is know how to run. But predators, tigers, lions, cats, foxes are all smarter than prey. And chances are intelligent life in outer space descend from predators just like us. Our eyes are to the front, right?
Really?
Yeah.
You don't imagine that a race of beings millions of years ahead of us would have evolved into peaceful, benevolent, technology-sharing folk?
There's a good chance that they have, but, you know, it's not 100%. And, well, first of all, they're not going to want to eat us because our DNA is going to be totally different from their DNA.
Besides, too far to travel for food. I don't imagine that either.
Yeah, and they're not going to come looking for natural resources like in the movies because there are plenty of uninhabited planets where there are no natives, where they have plenty of raw materials. So they're not going to want to plunder us for natural resources. There are plenty of uninhabited planets.
So what evil intent do you imagine possible?
I think they might come out of curiosity. However, as I said before, we don't know their intentions. They will have been descended from predators because predators are smarter than prey. And we shouldn't take the chance because, you know, there's only one Earth. So we shouldn't take the chance. So I think we should listen. And I think Carl Sagan and others who sent a disc containing our location with respect to the quasars in outer space, advertising our existence to alien life forms, is premature. I don't think we should do that at all.
Even our DNA, I think, was involved.
Well, what they did was they had this disk that was sent in space triangulating the location of the planet Earth with regards to the distant quasars in outer space, giving pictures of what we look like, giving scenes of the planet Earth. Today, of course, that disk would be considered, you know, barbarically primitive. But it's enough for aliens to get a pretty good sense of who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's premature to advertise our existence.
Okay, if we received a signal, in all likelihood, I doubt that it would be incidental transmissions. I would imagine it would be an intended transmission. And that's just me saying that, but I would think an intended transmission would have a far better chance of making it here and being deciphered than would just incidental television, microwave, and what have you. Wouldn't you imagine that?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, we do have the second law of thermodynamics, which says that anytime you have, you know, energy being produced in a certain place, you have energy loss, meaning that energy will seep out. You cannot hide your presence.
Right.
According to the laws of thermodynamics, you always create waste heat so that there will be waste electromagnetic, waste radiation coming from a planet, no matter how they try to keep their presence a secret. It will broadcast. And, you know, that's what the SETI people are hoping. They're hoping that it's going to be in the hydrogen frequencies because that's the only frequencies that they look at right now. But if that
By the way, is that going to change with this new setup, with the new
350? No, that's why I still give it a few percent in the sense that there are a lot of frequencies out there and there are a lot of ways to massage frequencies. You can split up speed frequencies. You can transform these frequencies. You know, even your email is compressed and is transformed when your email is sent. So there's a good chance that their emails, their transmissions will also be compressed and transformed. So it's not going to be simple. It's not going to be just the hydrogen frequencies.
Well, yeah, we've got the whole VHF, UHF, and then microwave region to be looking in, even up into light, for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, the hydrogen frequency is but one and kept fairly clear for the purposes we're discussing right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, my gosh, it could be virtually anywhere. So even these 350 telescopes are going to be looking at or near the hydrogen frequency.
That's right. And they're not going to look for laser frequencies, for example. Instead of having these radiations spread out as the inverse square law, you can have laser beams concentrate energy much more efficiently than electromagnetic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
What they're looking for is waste heat. That is the second law of thermodynamics, waste electromagnetic radiation that leaks out. They're looking for the Isle of Lucy transmissions that accidentally seep out into outer space, and you have no control over them, right?
Right.
If these aliens communicate by laser beams, they'll be directed, and it'll be much more difficult to eavesdrop on their conversations if they use directed energy like lasers. But, of course, you know, our equipment is not sensitive to those frequencies. So that's why I only give it a few percent. But it's the best shot we've had since the beginning of this whole process back in the post-war era.
How likely is it, Professor, that another civilization would recognize hydrogen, the hydrogen marker, as a pretty spiffy place to send an intentional signal?
I think it's pretty stupid.
However,
it's the only thing we have. Hydrogen is universal, so the SETI people say, why not, you know?
Pretty stupid?
I think it's a pretty stupid idea. However, they have a point, and that is they only have so much money. There are a lot of frequencies to look at, and they don't have the money to scan all frequencies. So they look at what are called the watering hole frequencies that any civilization in outer space would know, the hydrogen frequencies. But, you know, it's like the Pony Express. Today we don't think that the Pony Express is the most efficient way to communicate, right? There are more efficient ways than the Pony Express. So we keep on assuming that they're as primitive as us. Okay, we assume mm-hmm. that they have radio telescopes, that they are primitive just like us, that they're not that sophisticated, which I think is kind of silly. That's why I think still, even with this massive influx of funds, it's still a few percent chance that we'll actually receive signals from outer space. But hey, a few percent is a lot better than 0.0001%.
That's right. It's very exciting, actually, yes.
Yeah. So that's why, it's something to write home about. You know, it's something that has changed the complexion, the terrain, the landscape. And like I said, Kepler is going to even focus the search even more. The needle in the haystack. We'll find the needles. We'll know where the needles are in the haystack.
Okay, let's say we find a needle or some needles, and then we essentially keep it secret. And what do? We of course, try to understand what we're hearing, I suppose. But, I mean, how would you progress? Let's say you were called in,
mm-hmm.
and we had found an intelligent signal.
Mm-hmm.
How would you suggest proceeding from that point?
Well, first we need a Rosetta Stone. First, we have to translate what comes in. We don't know in what form this message will be, maybe binary, but then we have to translate it, you know, translate it into something that is recognizable. So we're going to have to bring in cryptographers. The Pentagon employs teams of these people to crack codes. We're going to have to bring in code breakers to simply decipher what is happening. Once these codes are deciphered, then we'll have to figure out whether it's just nothing but, you know, second law of thermodynamics, waste heat, I Love Lucy that leaked out from outer space, or, you know, transmissions that are directed at us, as you pointed out. Chances are they're just going to be random emissions that escape from their planet. We'll listen in on soap operas from these intelligent beings. And we'll begin to understand maybe a little bit about their culture.
So until we understood something or a lot about their culture, you would not be in favor of releasing any information to the general public of the world?
That's right. You know, it's kind of a bad thing to say, but I think if you think about it, it's probably the wisest thing. given the fact that all sorts of people are going to jump off on this, making all sorts of different kinds of theories and setting off panic and, you know, because we don't know what their intentions are. Once we figure out that they're peaceful people, that they don't, you know, conquer planets for the hell of it, then I think we can release it to the people that there are peaceful, intelligent beings out there mm-hmm. that we've made contact with and that we have nothing to fear from them. Okay, if we understand their history, you know, if some of their, you know, if they have a history channel and we eavesdrop on their history channel and we begin to understand their history, we'll begin to understand whether or not they can, you know, temper their, you know, aggressive tendencies that came out of the forest. I think all aliens will have that have essentially come from predator origins, very aggressive predator origins. And we'll see whether or not they've been able to tame these instincts, given the fact that we humans certainly have not been able to tame our aggressive instincts at all.
Well, I was just about to say, let's turn it around. Professor, imagine you're on another planet light years away. Mm-hmm. You begin detecting our signals, beginning, I suppose, with Hitler. But let's move it on and say that you essentially get to wait around, keep it secret, and you watch our History Channel, you watch the Discovery Channel, you watch a whole bunch of channels. You decode it, you begin to learn mm-hmm. what our society is currently doing and what we're all about.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of recommendations would you make to your superiors regarding the prospects of contact with Earth?
Well, I would say, you know, stay away. You know, they're basically, you know, they're an emerging, they're a type zero civilization. They haven't even reached type one status yet, and it's not clear they will reach type one status, that is planetary status. And these intelligent beings, if they are, you know, millions of years ahead of us, they could be type three. They could be galactic at that point. Listening in on, you know, feeble signals of a type zero civilization that mm-hmm. just came out of the swamp a few thousand years earlier, right?
Sure.
You know, 100,000 years ago, modern humans didn't even exist. I would figure that if they eavesdropped on our History Channel and saw all the footage from World War II.
Yes.
And if they saw, you know, I Love Lucy and all the soap operas, they would probably say, you know, leave these guys alone.
I mean, even if they got the recent stuff, which of course they wouldn't, they'd see us in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They'd see how we're handling the energy situation and what's likely to occur with the energy situation, that is, say, wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose they'd say, Fred, it's another one. Zap. Push the button.
Well, that's also possible, too. I mean, if we're ants in an anthill, what we have to worry about is being paved over by the workers next door.
Paved over.
And we may be paved over without even knowing that we're about to be paved over.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say let's try to find out their intentions before we advertise our existence and say, here we are. We are located in this sector of the Milky Way galaxy. I don't think we should do that yet. I think we should, you know, keep it under wraps. And if, you know, we do make contact with it, unfortunately, it'll come down to looking at military considerations first. Are there?
There would be a terrible temptation, wouldn't there, to aim a gigantic dish with lots of power at whatever it was and send an intentional transmission. I'm sure science would just love to proceed with that, wouldn't they?
That's right. And that's why I think it would be a very bad idea. The first thing is we're going to get scientists trying to be the first to make, you know, send a signal to these people and say, hi, here we are. We picked up your transmissions, right? I think that's a bad idea. You know, for example, the DNA and RNA of the bird flu, I mean, the Spanish flu virus was published in a medical journal, which I think is not wise at all, because any terrorist could then monkey with the greatest killer of modern times.
I think that's H5N1, right?
And it's been published. It's part of the public domain now.
You know, I never really considered that. You're absolutely right. All right, Professor, hold it right there. When we get back, I think we'll ask whether policy, national policy, world policy, would be better determined by science than politics. I'm Art Bell.